Commerce and Consumer Protection Committee. It's Thursday, February 16th, 2023, 12:30 p.m. We are here in room G15, and a quorum is present. Welcome, everybody. We're going to hear two bills today. The first bill is Senator Port's Senate File 6. Senator Port is unavailable, so the chair is going to take the opportunity to present the bill. Mr. Chair, welcome to your committee, and I understand you have an author's amendment.
Chair Friends, thank you for hearing Senate File 6. Yes, and I would like the committee to consider the A2 amendment as an author's amendment.
Senator Klein offers the A2 amendment to the bill. I was going to give Senator Klein a chance to describe it. Senator Rasmussen, Senator Klein, do you want to make any comments about the amendment before we go to member questions?
Mr. Chair, it's a delete everything amendment, so I believe I can just describe it when I go through the bill.
Okay. Thank you, Senator Klein. Senator Rasmussen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Question for Senator Klein. I noticed in the delete everything amendment here in subdivision 7 under damages that it changes the bill to recover three times the actual damages. And I just hadn't seen that in a previous version of this bill. And so I was just wondering where that language came from and the rationale behind having three times actual damages in this amendment.
Thank you, Senator Rasmussen. First of all, Senator Klein, if you would like to have us adopt the author's amendment, then to respond to questions, that's fine. Or if you want to respond, your preference.
Mr. Chair, yeah, it's the tradition of this body that the committee would vote on my author's amendment unanimously. And then I am glad to go through the bill, including that section, and then field questions.
Very good. Members, assuming that's agreeable to everybody, all in favor of adopting the author's amendment to Senate File 6, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed? The amendment is adopted. Senator Klein, would you like to walk through the bill as amended and then take Senator Rasmussen's question?
I would.
All right. Senator Klein.
And Mr. Chair, at your discretion, it may be best for me to walk through the bill, hear from our testifiers, and then field questions from the members, but I will leave it to your jurisdiction.
Members, let's do it that way. Senator Klein, why don't you present the bill? We'll have the testifiers. I'm assuming that's okay with you, Senator Rasmussen. All right. With that, Senator Klein.
Thank you, Chair Frantz, and members, for hearing Senate File 6. This is a bill chief authored by Senator Lindsey Port, who was unfortunately unable to be here today, but I am a co-author, and I'm glad to present the bill and bring it before your attention. I may, because I am not the chief author, phone a friend at occasion to help with the questions that the committee quite rightly will have, and I hope you will extend me some latitude in that regard. This bill establishes that during times of abnormal market disruption, which requires a declaration of a state of emergency by the governor, individuals are prohibited from selling or offering to sell an essential consumer good or service that is unconscionably excessive. An unconscionably excessive price is defined as a price that represents a gross disparity compared to the seller's average price of an essential good or service offered in a normal course of business in the 60-day period before an abnormal market disruption. When the governor declares an emergency, this bill specifies that the governor's emergency declaration must specify the geographical area of Minnesota to which the declaration applies. It also requires both the governor and the Department of Commerce to notify the public of the emergency declaration and prohibition. Mr. Chair, I want to draw members in particular to page 2 of the bill, which was, page 2 of the A2 amendment, which was worked out in conjunction with the retailers who wanted a little more clear language around what exactly price gouging is and is not. Lines 2.1 to 2.8 define what price gouging is not. It is not a price related to an increase in the cost of manufacturing, obtaining, replacing, providing, or selling a good or service. It's a price that is no more than 25% above the seller's average price during the 60-day period before the market disruption. It's not a price that is consistent with the fluctuations in applicable commodity markets or seasonal fluctuations, and it is not a contract price or the results of a price formula that was established before an abnormal market disruption. As noted already by members, this bill provides that the Attorney General may investigate and bring an action against a seller for an unconscionably excessive price during the time of an emergency declared by a governor. Violators can be fined up to $1,000 per sale or transaction with a maximum penalty of up to $25,000 per day, along with a private right of action. Mr. Chair, with that, I would suggest we go to my testifiers.
Thank you, Senator Klein. There was a question whether or not you wanted Ms. Gruenwald-Nolner to go through the fiscal note briefly before we had the witnesses testify. The chair is fine either way. Do you have a preference?
Please do.
All right. With that, Ms. Gruenwald-Nolner, am I saying that right?
Yes. Yep, that's right. Mr. Chair and members, the fiscal note in your packets goes over Senate File 6 before the amendment was adopted, but looking at the amendment, I don't think that would change any of the fiscal note implications listed here. There are no costs detailed in the fiscal note. The fiscal note went both to the Commerce Department, which on page 4 of the fiscal note, under assumptions, Commerce is assuming that Senate File 6 will have no impact on the department. And under the Attorney General, on page 6 of the fiscal note, under assumptions, the Attorney General's office is assuming that it's impossible to quantify potential costs associated with investigating and enforcing price gouging that may occur during an event of unknown extent and duration. And the AG also assumes that they would seek relief in supplemental or emergency budget bill. That would be in response to a declared emergency or abnormal market condition. And the AG also states under expenditure and or revenue formula that during the COVID-19 pandemic, via the Executive Order 2010 issued by the governor, where the AG's office was investigating and enforcing a prohibition on price gouging, that during that time they were able to use their current resources to carry out that prohibition. And with that, I'll stand for any questions on the fiscal note, but again, there's no costs detailed here.
Thank you, Ms. Gruenwald-Nolner. Members, any questions to the fiscal note? Senator Howe? All right. With that, Senator Klein, ready to return to the witnesses. The list I have has Justin Stoffran listed first. Mr. Stoffran, if you want to come forward. And then the next witness we have listed is Tyler Blackman. So, Tyler Blackman on deck. Mr. Stoffran, welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself and present your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Justin Stoffran. I'm the Anti-Monopoly Director for the Minnesota Farmers Union, which is a grassroots organization representing family farmers, ranchers, and rural communities across Minnesota since 1918. I'm here today to share MFU's support of Senate File 6, which would take the long overdue step of prohibiting price gouging in Minnesota. I want to thank Chair Klein as well as Senator Port for their leadership on this issue. While I'll talk about the perspective our members have on this issue as farmers, MFU members are also consumers, and like everyone else, have felt the pain of rising prices at the grocery store, the gas pump, or the local pharmacy. Recent studies, one by the Federal Reserve Bank of Kansas City and another by the Federal Reserve Bank of Boston, have found that anti-competitive behavior is a key driver of increased prices. Specifically, those studies found that corporate profits were responsible for over half of recent price increases, and that a lack of competition allowed dominant companies to raise prices above what was needed to address increased input costs. With concentration in the economy having increased by 50% just since 2005, leaving a small handful of firms in control of industries across the economy, it's critical that Minnesota have additional tools for cracking down on profiteering. Prohibiting price gouging is a key first step. For family farmers specifically, while their neighbors are paying record prices at the grocery store, while corporate monopolies see massive increases in profits, family farmers are seeing less. The farmer's share of the food dollar has dropped from 50 cents since in 1952 to just 14.3 cents in 2021, the lowest on record. It is time that Minnesota join the majority of other states with this basic protection for consumers. This is a good first step in addressing the harms Minnesotans face from extreme economic consolidation, and MFU looks forward to working with Chair Klein and Senator Port to make this legislation as strong as possible. We also hope to work with all of you on additional measures that will address the extreme concentration in the economy, ensure fair and competitive markets for Minnesotans, and help people afford their lives. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Stofferin. With that, we'll invite Tyler Blackman forward to testify. Mr. Blackman, welcome to the committee. Could you please introduce yourself and then present your testimony?
Of course. Chair friends, members of the committee, my name is Tyler Blackman. I'm a second year law student at the University of Minnesota Law School, where I focus my studies on consumer protection. I'm here today to urge the members to vote in favor of this bill as amended for a few reasons. First, the pandemic that we've just emerged from will not be the last time that corporations try to exploit a public emergency to turn a profit on the backs of consumers. But the next crisis will be different. The very nature of abnormal market disruptions is that they are unexpected. They can leave consumers suddenly vulnerable in a new and disorienting way. So we need to do the work now to craft a comprehensive statute that will anticipate any number of future abnormal market disruptions. While this pandemic may have involved the price gouging of masks, hand sanitizer, and personal protective equipment, the next crisis could very well involve price gouging of medicine, gasoline, food. Second, Minnesota is rapidly becoming an outlier nationally as a state that does not protect its consumers from price gouging. 38 states in the District of Columbia have already put laws in the books specifically banning price gouging during abnormal market disruptions, and many of those are even more strict than the one in front of you today. Only 12 states do not, and of those, many are actively considering changing that right now. Finally, if you hear nothing else that I say today, be sure to hear this. Corporations will not follow this law unless you include a private right of action. To craft any effective consumer protection legislation, it is imperative that consumers be able to bring suit to recover for their injuries. We need a private right of action in addition to civil penalties in this bill for a few reasons. First, it puts money back into the pockets of everyday people who are abused by price gouging. If corporations are going to extract money from consumers, those same consumers deserve to recoup the money that was illegally taken from them. Second, the Office of the Attorney General is already stretched thin and cannot possibly bring an action against every single corporation for every single infraction in violation of this law. The private right of action is a far more effective enforcement mechanism. Third, and most importantly, there is no financial incentive. There is no financial incentive for large corporations to follow this law if they only face the possibility of a civil penalty. Just think about it logically. If you're a large corporation who could make millions of dollars price gouging consumers during an abnormal market disruption, and the only possible penalty is a meager $25,000 fine, you don't have to be a savvy business person to understand that the corporation has a strong incentive to violate the law and choose millions of dollars over the slight possibility of a $25,000 fine. How do we know that's true? How do we know that this is the only kind of enforcement the corporations take seriously? Because they're going to tell you. Because they know that the previous legislators have, the reason the Minnesota legislature included a private right of action in things like the Consumer Fraud Act and treble damages in the antitrust statutes is that they know what I know and the chamber knows and the NFIB knows. Corporations will not follow this law unless you include a private right of action. I urge the committee members to remember who elected them to office. It was people, not corporations. People who suffered from the abusive practices of corporations who sought to exploit their vulnerabilities during one of the most volatile economic periods in American history. I urge a vote yes on this legislation as amended. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Blackman. With that, we'll move to the testimony of Bruce Newstad from the Minnesota Retailers Association. Mr. Newstad. Mr. Newstad, welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself and present your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you to Senator Port and Senator Klein for standing in on this bill. My name is Bruce Newstad with the Minnesota Retailers Association. I work with about 1,200 stores across the state. About a third of those are what you'd probably consider Main Street mom-and-pop family-owned businesses. About a third are regional retailers, and about a third are national retailers. I just want to take this moment to thank Senator Port for an overall really thoughtful approach on what price gouging might look like and what a bill might look like. Back in 2021, as an organization, we've been working on what an approach to price gouging could look like and could be leaned on during a state of an emergency. And more recently, we've been collecting the feedback and working with other groups like the Chamber of Commerce on a bill and a bill structure that really tries to distinguish between bad actors taking advantage of consumers during an emergency versus adjusting prices as kind of normally happens based on how the market works. I want to Thanks, Senator Port. Her amendment does take a lot of step toward kind of clarifying and providing for some good guidance to not only retailers, but consumers and regulators as well. An important part of her bill, as you've heard, really requires two things, and I think this is worth pointing out. There is a requirement that there be a state of emergency. A governor has to activate a state of emergency, and then he has to follow that, he or she would have to follow that up with activating this specific statute. That dual declaration feels like it's a very important part of this legislation that Senator Port's put forward. We also appreciate kind of that geographic targeting that appears in the amendment. That's an important part from a clarity perspective as well. I was going to go into what's really important about this bill is defining what price gouging is not, but actually Chair Klein did a really nice job explaining each of those pieces relative to the 25%, et cetera, so I won't go into that, but I will say that those provisions to defining what price gouging is not, sometimes referred to as a safe harbor, are really an important part of helping retailers, consumers, suppliers, and regulators really understanding what's expected if this were invoked. So I want to thank Senator Port for that clarification and the amendment. And again, it goes a long way toward having everybody understand what's expected. And while I don't want to take away from those positives, there are a few things in the bill that we'd love to continue to have conversations with the author on. As drafted, when a governor invokes this, the price gouging statute automatically stays on for 30 days after a state of emergency has ended. I think it's worth discussing whether or not a governor may want either a shorter price gouging statute or not more or less than 30 days relative to its expiration after a state of emergency. And really most concerning, this bill does, as you just heard, provide the private right of action along with triple damages and attorney's fees. I guess I'd respectfully disagree with the previous testifier. I think most Minnesota businesses do a really good job complying with the law. In fact, that's what I spend a lot of time working with retailers on. How do you comply with the law and make sure you're doing it right? So not only doing right by your consumers, but also right by the law. The penalties are extremely high. They are out of line with other states with price gouging statutes. And really, we want to think about how do we protect those that make an honest mistake and get at the bad actors. As I mentioned earlier, expectations under the statute are really important to understand. And we are concerned by the private right of action in here. Our opinion is the enforcement on the Attorney General's office is really the right enforcement model. It stands for the best opportunity for the most expedited action, the most predictable application of the law, professional investigations, and consistent enforcement. And we hope to continue with Senator Port on that relative to what a private right of action might look like if it were not in the bill and what penalties might look like going forward as well. So in the end, I just want to comment and say one of the things I like about this bill is we kind of hope it's rarely used, right? You think about times when this would be used, and they are the worst of times. And so we hope this is rarely used, and we actually appreciate a fiscal note that says, you know what, this might not be used next year. I think that's optimistic for all of us to hope that things stay in place and we don't experience the types of emergencies that we did during the pandemic, et cetera. So I just want to thank, again, Chair Klein and Senator Port for their work on this bill, and we look forward to continuing the conversations forward. I know this is not the Judicial Committee, so I don't have a really great no private right of action argument for you today, outside of saying I really do think most Minnesota businesses are happy to comply with the law. They understand that importance, and we think the Attorney General is the best place to run the enforcement for this bill. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Newstead. Are there any members of the public who wish to testify on Senate File 6 that we did not list? Seeing none, thank you again, Mr. Newstead. Thank you, Mr. Chair. We'll go to member questions. If I recall, Senator Rasmussen, you had a question. Senator Rasmussen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My apologies for jumping the gun on my earlier question, but wanted to direct members to the damages section that a couple of the testifiers have talked about. It's subdivision 7, and in there it says not only allows for a private right of action, but says that they shall recover 3 times the actual damages sustained. And so, Mr. Chair, my question for Senator Klein is, where did that come from? I haven't seen that in previous versions. I just wanted to see what the justification for that was.
I appreciate that, Senator Rasmussen. Senator Klein is here on behalf of Senator Port, happy to try to answer any questions from any members. Also has a couple of people here in the audience that he might refer to. Senator Klein, treble damages. Do you want to phone a friend or?
Senator Frentz, I'll try to field it myself. Okay. Thank you, Chair Frentz and Senator Rasmussen. And I think you heard from the testifiers that there are Minnesotans who firmly believe This is the only way to have a powerful enforcement tool within this bill. And I would say, in answer to your question, where did it come from? It came from Minnesotans just like those who have testified. I will also add, of course, the next obvious path for this bill is the Judiciary Committee, where questions like these are addressed with wisdom and intelligence and can be discussed further at that point.
Thank you, Senator Klein. Senator Rasmussen, any follow-up?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, I appreciate that, and would just encourage Senator Port to continue working with stakeholders, especially on this damages piece, given the concerns that have been brought up here today. And Mr. Chair, I'll just comment on this proposal broadly. We, during the governor's peacetime emergency for COVID, we actually got to have a test run of this bill. I believe it was about for 18 months, we had an executive order that put into place a similar price gouging framework. And over that time, the Attorney General's office received about 2,400 complaints that they investigated. Many of them were for small local retailers who had the price of toilet paper or eggs or other basic goods increased during that time, and largely due to supply chain shortages. And over all those 2,400 complaints, the Attorney General's office only brought 6 formal complaints. And so for me, this test run kind of showed, contrary to some of the testimony we've heard here today, that Minnesota business owners respect their communities, they respect the relationships that they have with their customers, and that by and large, what we saw during that peacetime emergency, they're not trying to price gouge their neighbors. And oftentimes, the Attorney General's office followed the receipts all the way back to the farm to see that the price of eggs actually went up. And it became a burden for many good actors, good Minnesota businesses, who just were facing the same supply chain issues that state government, local government, and Minnesota consumers were facing. And so I just worry that this is a little bit of a solution chasing a problem. And very rarely do we get an opportunity to test out a law before it goes on the books. And this one, getting 6 formal actions out of 2,400 investigations to me shows us that Minnesota businesses are trying to do right by their customers.
Thank you, Senator Rasmussen. I have Senator Howe and then Senator Latz.
Chair Friends.
Senator Klein, do you want to respond? Sure. Good. Senator Klein.
Thank you, Chair Friends. First of all, I would firmly agree that almost all Minnesota businesses very much want to do right by their customers and are not looking to exploit a pandemic or to abuse their customers. And this law truly is guided towards the bad actors. I would also say that the low number of investigations pursued by the Attorney General may not be sufficient evidence that a problem did not exist. As we heard from our testifiers, the Attorney General's office may be ill-equipped, particularly during those strenuous years of the pandemic, to investigate appropriately as they should. And that is why the civil right of action is included in this bill.
Thank you, Senator Klein. And now we have Senator Howe, then Senator Latz, then Senator Dames. Senator Howe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And my question, I've got a couple of questions. And one of them pertains to, if you look at line 2.14 under the abnormal market disruption, the governor has to specify a specific geographic area of Minnesota where the declaration applies. But yet when you come down to the prohibition in lines 2.23 and 2.26, says nothing about a specific area. So I'm confused about when he declares it in a specific geographic area, but the prohibition goes where? Doesn't it? I'm just confused. Does it go in a specific geographic area or is it statewide? I'm just looking for a little guidance. I think it would help us to define that a little better.
Thank you very much, Senator Howe. Fair question. Senator Klein?
I'm okay taking
Senator
the question,
Klein.
Chair, and counsel can help us if the language is unclear, but it seems to me that the prohibition would apply only to the area that had been geographically described in the state of emergency. So.
Senator Howe, any follow-up?
Well, I think it should be. I think that's a question to staff, so I'll wait for a response from staff.
Senator Klein, maybe we'll go to Mr. Hudala. Mr. Hudala.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Senator. I do agree that the language is a bit ambiguous as currently written. in my interpretation, I would agree with the author's interpretation that it would likely be interpreted to only apply to the specific geographic region in which the governor, you know, made the declaration. That being said, it is ambiguous and could potentially be interpreted both ways.
All right, thank you, Mr. Hodala. Back to Senator Howe. Senator Howe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Something we should probably look at. I'm not looking to draft an amendment on the fly on this thing, but hopefully by the time I see it in the judiciary, maybe it's changed. The other piece I'm kind of concerned with is I wish, you know, when I look at it in lines 1.5, it says the Attorney General shall, which I think we have been changing most shalls to must. And then I look back here on line 2.30, the Attorney General on the Enforcement Authority, the Attorney General may. The only concern I have there is I would prefer to see that must, because I don't want to see the Attorney General picking winners and losers on who he's going to go look at and who he's not going to look at. If he gets a complaint, and especially with the additional staff and funding that we've given him, I believe that he should go out and take a look at everyone he gets a complaint on and not pick who he wants to go look at and who he doesn't want to go look at. If he gets a complaint, he should go look. And that's what I've got so far, Mr. Chair, and I'll leave it at that. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Howe. Good question. Senator Klein, do you want to respond to Senator Howe before we go on? Senator Klein.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I appreciate the vigor that goes behind the suggestion that we change line 2.30 to a must. At this time, I would ask committee members to keep it as a may and leave the Attorney General with the prerogative to pick and choose egregious cases and maybe overlook those that are less significant. But I'm certainly willing to advise Senator Port that she should work with Senator Howe going forward.
Thank you very much, Senator Klein. With that, Senator Latz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You know, to that last point, I think it's important for the Attorney General's office to have some discretion. For one thing, if Senator Howe wants to change it to must, I assume Senator Howe is going to include a massive increase in the Attorney General's office's budget in order to enable them to do that. Otherwise, it would create a completely impossible situation. Secondly, I'm not sure that Senator Howe or anyone would want the Attorney General's office to investigate absolutely every business that is complained of to the Attorney General's office to either exonerate them or bring an action for damages against them. You'd have a lot of vendettas going on. Someone gets aggrieved by a business, they decide they're going to make a complaint, and the Attorney General has to investigate it. Even if the complaint is completely baseless and the Attorney General is able to determine that on its face at the beginning without an investigation, yet a business is going to have to spend the money to defend themselves against a mandatory AG investigation. To me, that would be really, really bad for the small businesses that Mr. Newstead represents, as well as the rest of businesses in Minnesota. It was interesting to note the test run that Senator Rasmussen referred to, and I think we're in a unique situation here. We have that benefit. But I think I would agree with Senator Klein's response. Not only does it perhaps show a lack of resources on the part of the Attorney General's office to be able to bring more than six formal complaints, but actually I think it demonstrates a lot of restraint on the part of the Attorney General's office in picking and choosing how they're going to use their resources. Maybe they felt it was important to focus on the bigger, more public bad actors to set an example to everyone else to say, look, this is what's going to happen to you. We're going to get the most bang for the buck with this particular investigation because the damages appear to be much more widespread with these six bad actors. That's an example to the rest of you also that we have this tool, we have this power, and we're willing to use it. Do you really want to take that risk? The only other example is, and my guess is they're more likely to go after the big actors where the bigger damages and the greater number of consumers in Minnesota are affected than necessarily you know, a smaller operator that's affecting fewer consumers. And then the only other thing I'm going to add, besides the fact that, of course, we'll take up the issue of damages and civil penalties in the Judiciary Committee, where I understand this is going next. We'll get more information on that, I guess. I'm interested to know the difference between Shell versus May on the treble damages in Subdivision 7 and what examples there are in other statutes where it's a mandatory trebling of damages versus a discretionary on the part of the court. I'm also curious to take a look at what the other civil penalties are in some of the other consumer protection statutes to see if this is an outlier, and whether it ought to be an outlier, or whether the comparison group is such that this is out of line. I don't know that off the top of my head. I'd be interested in that information. And also in how many of the consumer protection statutes that are listed in Section 8.31 also contain a private right of action. I think a fair number of them do, but I don't know off the top of my head, and I think it'd be helpful information for us to have when this comes before committee. But I guess I wanted to make one other note, which is the use of gasoline prices. Everyone knows that as soon as there's a major disruption in the supply of oil in the world, and the price per barrel starts skyrocketing from $63 per barrel to $110 per barrel for North Sea crude, that somehow the prices at the pump respond within a day, and they're, you know, just shockingly speedy increases in the prices at the pump, when everyone knows that the wholesale price of that gas and the cost of the oil that went into that gas was incurred months before, as it was purchased on the world market and went into the refinery and then was producing the gas and then transported to the gas station where we're putting it into our tank. So there's price gouging going on somewhere in there, and it's not at all related to the wholesale cost or the cost of producing that gasoline before it gets to the consumer. Shockingly, when those price shocks go down and the price of oil goes down back to $63 per barrel, somehow it takes 2 or 3 months for the price at the pump to follow that change. Now, I understand that because by that point, the price at the pump reflects the wholesale increases that went into producing that product. But there's absolutely no doubt in my mind that corporations that have the ability to get away with price gouging, no, absolutely that's price gouging, will do it if they think they can get away with it. And we're talking about some of the wealthiest companies in the world. $25,000 a day is nothing to them. It's a cost of, it's not even a nuisance amount, let alone a cost of doing business. This isn't quite analogous, but many may remember when the Ford Pinto was sued because of the location of the gas tank that they located at the back of the vehicle, which was particularly susceptible to exploding and killing the occupants when there was a rear-end collision. And there were internal documents at Ford that made clear, and this is only found out because there were civil lawsuits on the behalf of dead plaintiffs' estates. There were internal documents at Ford that basically said they knew exactly what they were doing, but the cost of paying off the families of the people that were dead was less than the cost of redesigning the Pinto and relocating the gas tank. So some of us don't always think that corporations do the right thing just because it's the right thing to do. Bottom line is corporations have a fiduciary duty to maximize their profits to their shareholders. And some of them are more restrained than others in the marketplace and the laws that they're facing. Now, I'm not going to sit here and say that every corporation is bad. I don't think so. I think 95% of corporations are people that are good people. They're doing the right thing. They're trying to make an honest living. My law practice is a corporate entity, too. There are lots of reasons for that. But corporations are generally law-abiding and good citizens, and they go home every day to the neighborhoods with their neighbors that are buying their products, right? But there are some corporations that don't do that. We have to have a big enough tool in the tool chest to hold them accountable. It seems to me this is a bill that does that. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you very much, Senator Latz. I have Senator Dames
next on the list. Senator Howe, did you want to speak to that point before Senator Daines?
I actually wanted to speak to that, to some of those points that Senator Latz brought up. And
Senator Howe.
My viewpoint on it is, as far as giving the Attorney General some latitude, I believe he's got the latitude to determine how deep he goes into an investigation, and he can, with a few phone calls, maybe wipe somebody off and say, yeah, we looked at that, doesn't appear to be anything. But to just say he's not going to look at someone, I got an issue with that, and I think he should, as Senator Rasmussen said, he looked at 2,400 and came down to 6. He investigated them all. Now, to what depth and what staff he put at him, that's another question, and this doesn't dictate that he would go after the number of staff he puts or the number of hours he puts, but at least I think they should take a look at every complaint that comes in. Your example about the gas station, I will say that, you know, I knew a guy that ran a gas station bait shop, and the volatility of the gas that he had to buy from the wholesaler as it went into his tanks basically put him out of business, because it was so volatile, he could not keep up with the, he was an independent, he just could not adjust his prices in order to keep up with that. And it basically, because of the what he had in the tank, he didn't sell enough to where by the time the prices, when he got the price of that fuel, and he had to charge more, when everybody else then dropped their prices, he couldn't respond fast enough, and it actually put him out of business because he just couldn't fluctuate his prices as the big corporation fuel stations could. So I don't think it's the guy on the end that's usually the independent fuel station that is actually gouging anybody. It's up the chain a bit, and it's a little bit larger than those folks. So I you know, but that's my comment, Senator Latz, and I appreciate our discussion.
Thank you, Senator Howe. Senator Daines.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and Senator Klein. It's my understanding that the price cannot go up more than 25% during the time of the emergency or during the time of the stated emergency of the prior 60 days. Would that be correct?
Senator Klein.
Mr. Chair, Senator Daines, that is how I read the language at 2.1 to 2.8.
Senator Daines.
I do have some cause for concern there. Not too many of you in this room probably were in business back in the 1970s, but in the 1970s, there were late 70s, early 80s, when the inflation was totally out of control, there were a lot of parts and stuff for automobiles that went up over 30% in a period of 1 year. And so what this bill would do is say that either the people had to sell that, would have, if that happens again, which it very likely can, if that happens again, then the people are going to have to sell that part at a lesser, at a price less than their cost, or not sell it. And in the case back in the 1970s and early 80s, there would have been several automobiles that would have been parked along the side of the road because there wouldn't have been parts to fix them, only because we had a bill that said that we can only raise the price that much, and the retailers couldn't have picked the part up and sold it and been able to supply the parts. So what happens in that situation?
Senator Klein.
Mr. Chair, Senator Daines, and again, the bill speaks to only during a state of emergency or a pandemic, something like that, and only to essential goods and services. So I'm not sure that the example of the auto parts that go up during inflation applies, but I would think that the protections describe increases in the cost of manufacturing, obtaining, replacing, providing, or selling, et cetera, would protect against that circumstance as well.
Senator Daines?
Follow up. So what you're saying is then they would have been able to continue to make the part and increase the price past 25%?
Senator Klein?
Mr. Chair, Senator Daines, if they could demonstrate that the cost of manufacturing that part had increased by that amount, they would be protected from this legislation.
Senator Daines?
Yeah, I'll leave that one at that, but that would, you know, I mean, we could have that inflationary period within this because the COVID was, what, 18 months we were under? And so in an 18-month period, we could see prices go up more than 25% on not an average inflation, but on certain parts and certain things like that, we could see that be more than 25% at the manufacturer's level easily. That's what happened in the 1970s and early 80s. And so I look back at that, and that does cause some concern that I'm not sure that there's protections in here that would allow to take care of that. But thank you for your information.
Thank you, Senator Dames. Senator Duckworth.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I understand you're not the chief author, so if it's okay if we can't answer some of these, but I have a few brief questions. I'm curious if this applies to utilities.
Senator Klein.
Mr. Chair and Senator Duckworth, and I think at this point, with the discretion of the committee, I would like Representative Stevenson to join me at the table, since I'm familiar with the questioning lines of Senator Duckworth, and I know he gets fairly specific. So
Here's what the chair would suggest. If you want Representative Stevenson to come forward and testify, I'm okay with that, absent any member objections and setting aside questions of protocol. If you want to just confer with Representative Stevenson, that's fine. Up to you, Mr. Chair.
Your choice. I'll have him come and answer the questions directly.
Representative Stevenson, welcome to the Senate.
I wore a tie and everything.
Nice to see you, Representative. Did you get the question, or do you need it repeated?
No, I heard the question, Mr. Chair, and Senator Duckworth. So if you look at the definition of essential consumer goods or service, it says including without limitation and lists some things. Utilities aren't in that list, but it says before that any good or service that is vital for the health, safety, or welfare of the public. And so I do believe it could include utility services during that time. However, I also would note all of the exceptions that constitute the safe harbor, and many of those would have particular application to the business model of a utility.
Thank you for that, Representative Stevenson. Senator Duckworth, we also have some price rate regulation for the investor-owned utilities, so price fluctuation is often regulated by the Public Utilities Commission. With that, Senator Duckworth.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate that, and thank you, Representative Stevenson. You're right. It does say essential customer good or service. Some of the things listed are fuel, gasoline, and other things. I just want to make sure that, and I don't have the sort of energy policy knowledge that you do, of course, Mr. Chair, but I just want to make sure that we understand fully and completely what this may be applied to. I could see some pretty substantial implications if it does apply to utilities or could be interpreted as applying to utilities, especially if we're talking about potential emergency situations, whether it be a natural disaster or what have you. My follow-up question would be, it talks about essential goods or services and lists them off. I guess as determined by who? Is this the Attorney General that determines whether or not something meets the criteria of an essential customer good or service, or who is the determining authority?
Senator Klein, Representative Stevenson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Duckworth. What Subdivision 6 allows is the Attorney General to bring an enforcement action in a court of law, and Subdivision 7 in this file allows for a private right of action. So the ultimate determination of many of these factors would be left to the fact finder, and whatever enforcement action happens there would be up to the Attorney General, whoever's bringing the private right of action, to prove all of the elements of the charge, including, including that the good in question was an essential good of good or service.
Senator Duckworth.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Stephen. I think that highlights maybe one of the main issues that folks have with that Subdivision 7. To me, that opens it up to be a fairly potentially broad definition or threshold of what might be considered an essential consumer good or service. And I just see that as something that we have to be mindful of as it pertains to this bill and how it might play out in reality. And I think there are certain aspects of the bill which makes sense and seem to get at a good intent. There has to be an emergency in place, geographical area, et cetera. I get all that. But I do think there are some areas specific to that subdivision that cause a little bit of concern. I want to follow up on some questions or some points that were raised earlier. I don't know the specific time period this references. I'm assuming it's during the pandemic. But it was shared with earlier that the AG's office had about 2,400 complaints and only brought formal action in 6 instances. So I'm wondering how many of the 2,400 complaints were against what would be considered big corporations versus small businesses?
Senator Klein, Representative Stevenson.
Mr. Chair, Senator Duckworth, I don't have the answer to that question. I'm sure if you ask the Attorney General, they could provide more information. The one thing I will point out, and I not to contradict Senator Rasmussen, but maybe to add another layer of detail, is that not all complaints were resolved with formal action. In other words, there were substantiated instances of price gouging that didn't result in a formal, court action, but were resolved by settlement. And I believe the number is much larger and into the hundreds when you include the instances that were settled and not brought to a into an action where you get to six.
Senator Duckworth.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, specific to the six in which there was formal action, do we have any idea how many of those were big corporations versus small businesses?
Senator Klein or Representative Stevenson.
Mr. Chair, Senator Duckworth, we do not have that answer. We're glad to reach out to the Attorney General's office and get specifics.
Senator Duckworth.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Could you just share with everybody what might have been some real-life scenarios or findings in any of these instances in which the Attorney General took action, whether it was of the six or any of the potentially others that they were involved in?
Senator Klein or Representative Stevenson. Senator Klein.
So, Mr. Chair, Senator Duckworth, I don't have the facts of the six cases in front of me right now. Here's what I tell you is that there are instances that I can point to, for example, in Texas when we had the big power outage a year ago, where, for example, hotel rooms went up dramatically overnight, over $1,000 a night for a hotel room. Bottled water prices going up. I think everyone's familiar with the toilet paper discussions from during the pandemic. So there's a lot of instances. I'm not familiar with the six specific instances as I sit in front of you today.
Mm-hmm. Senator Duckworth.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Stevenson. And I can appreciate that. I guess I'm looking for, or what I'd be curious to hear of, is the specific instances in the state of Minnesota that would have led to or that would make sense for the justification of this legislation as it pertains to our state statutes, of course. So, but I get it, and I can certainly try to research some of that on my own. I do want to make a couple other comments about the general discussion. There are over 533,000 small businesses in the state of Minnesota, which make up 99.5% of Minnesota businesses. They employ nearly half of all Minnesota employees at 1.3 million people. And if you look at what the average profit of a small business is, or what the average salary of a small business owner is, it's under $100,000. And so when you look at some of the fines being proposed, if it's $25,000 a day, you'll put a lot of businesses out of business in the course of a business week if they're being levied the maximum fine against them. And that doesn't begin to include what they might be exposed to under Subdivision 7. And so I think, honestly, there are many portions of the bill that I could get behind. The addition of the private right of action is an alarming one that has the potential to be misused, I think. And that's what's alarming to me. And I was trying to get a sense of whether or not this truly is something that big corporations here in Minnesota are being found to be in violation of, and I haven't heard anything yet that demonstrates that. Not saying it's not the case. Maybe if I get some of this information, I'll find that it will be. But I'm going to guess of the 2,400 complaints, that a vast majority were levied against small businesses. And of the six, I don't know what fines or whatnot were imposed. Obviously, they were probably justified. But if we had 2,400 complaints to the Attorney General's office, I can only imagine how many potential lawsuits might take place if this becomes law and anybody and everybody is allowed to potentially sue over what they think might be price gouging because maybe their utilities went up or some other thing that they're not happy about. And as I just shared with you, many small businesses, if they have to deal with that legal expense, it would be significant. The last thing I'll say, Mr. Chair, is there have been some requests that a provision of this bill include that the AG's office would notify a business that the investigation is complete or done, what have you. I think that's very, very important. I think that seems like a reasonable request, and I would hope to see it get added to this bill. So I appreciate the answers to the questions, and that's all I've got, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Senator Duckworth. Members, any further questions? Senator Klein.
Just in response. So I can give you one example of a Minnesota company that actually was sort of subject to an attorney general's line of action during the last pandemic, and it was Sparebow Farms, a Minnesota-based agri-producer, found to have raised prices 150% during the pandemic, and they reached a settlement in which the producer agreed to limit prices to 20% of the pre-pandemic level. So that was one specific example. I guess I would agree with the statement that a $25,000 per day fee on a small business, a local business, could be crippling or deadly in a very short order. And that is why I think the language around the Attorney General's prerogative to investigate and impose penalties as a may rather than a must is quite significant. The $25,000 number is important when we're dealing with very large corporations, multinationals, in order to inflict a level of pain that actually will have an impact, like with the Ford Pinto and what occurred there. But the discretion of the Attorney General to make sure nobody wants to put the neighborhood grocery store out of line, out of business, particularly if they've made an honest mistake or don't sort of have the data gathering practices to comply with this law effectively. And that's where the Attorney General's discretion comes in. Lastly, I would say, and again, this goes more expertly to the Judiciary Committee where you're about to send this bill, Mr. Chair, but informing a subject of investigation that the investigation has resolved and is no longer in impact is simply not the way that legal investigations are pursued, either in criminal or in civil cases. And there are a lot of good reasons why that just doesn't make sense as a policy. But again, I'll leave that to the next committee, and I urge a green vote on this.
Thank you, Senator Klein. Members, we're going to move. Senator Wicklund, can I get a motion to pass Senate File 6 as amended and recommend to pass it to the Committee on Judiciary and Public Safety? Thank you. The question is on the motion of roll call requested. Roll call will be granted. The question is on the motion of Senator Wicklund that Senate File 6 as amended be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Committee on Judiciary and Public Safety. With that, the clerk will take the roll.
Chair Klein.
Aye.
Senator Seeberger.
Yes.
Senator Dames.
No.
Senator Duckworth.
No.
Senator Frentz.
Yes.
Senator Wicklund.
Yes.
Senator Howe.
Nay.
Senator Latz.
Aye.
Senator Jean.
Yes.
Senator Rasmussen.
No.
There being six aye votes and four nay votes, the motion prevails. Senate File 6, as amended, is recommended to pass and is re-referred to the Committee on Judiciary and Public Safety. With that, members, we're going to hear Senate File 1138. The chief author is also our chair, Senator Klein. Senator Klein, welcome back to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, committee, for hearing Senate File 1138. And before we proceed, I'd like to do an author's amendment, the A7.
Thank you. Senator Klein offers the A7 author's amendment. Senator Klein, do you want to speak to it or else?
Let me tell you that, Mr. Chair and committee, I'm going to offer two amendments here. The first is an author's amendment, which is in response to several advocates from the community who came forward and wanted to strengthen sort of the privacy initiatives around this bill. And we were receptive to those and have worked to do those, and I will have, after the vote, I'll have counsel go through the A7 and describe what it accomplishes. I'm going to have a second amendment, Mr. Chair, and let me explain that briefly as well. This committee was misreferred, this bill was misreferred initially to the Judiciary Committee, and it made its first stop there when it was supposed to stop here. In that committee, a small oral amendment was put on, which is no longer active because it is now coming to this committee. And my second amendment will be a voted upon amendment, which will simply put that back on and redo the work of the Judiciary Committee. So.
Very good. First member, Senator Klein, offers the A7 amendment. All in favor of adopting the A7, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? The A7 is adopted. Senator Klein, you mentioned a second amendment, although he did not give the number.
Mr. Chair, I would like the committee to also vote on the A3 amendment.
Senator Klein offers the A3 amendment. Members, that should be in your packet. Senator Klein, do you want to speak to the A3 or just have us vote on it?
This was language brought forward to include some authority under Chapter 13 of Minnesota State Statute, and it was brought forward in the Judiciary Committee to ensure adequate enforcement.
Thank you, Senator Klein. Members, to the A3, all in favor of adopting the A3 amendment, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? The amendment is adopted. Senator Klein, to Senate File 1138 as amended.
Thank you so much, Mr. Chair, and thank you, committee, for indulging those two amendments. I will speak briefly to the bill, and then I will ask you to call on Mr. Hudala to speak to the A2 or A7. Senate File 1138 it establishes various protections for consumers who submit biological samples to direct to consumer genetic testing companies. The bill requires testing companies to obtain the consumer's express consent. It provides privacy notices to the consumer, and it protects the security of the consumer's genetic data from unauthorized disclosures. As you will hear from our testifiers who are from the industry, this is actually a bill brought forward by providers of these genetic testing companies who feel that it's important really to their brand protection that consumers have control over that data once it's submitted. If you've taken one of these tests at home and sent in your data, you certainly don't want that data used down the road to prosecute you criminally or to investigate your or to direct commercial activity towards you. And that's what this bill really aims to do, is give you control over your data. Currently in the state of Minnesota, there is no legislation around this whatsoever. So this is a new initiative to create some consumer control over this data. Even though that's the case, we did hear several vigorous concerns from data privacy experts, and we have tried to respond to those concerns in the A7. And Mr. Chair, with your indulgence, I think the next best step might be to have Mr. Hudala describe the A7 and then go to testifiers.
Thank you very much, Senator Klein. Mr. Hudala.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Senator Klein. I will briefly walk through the A7 amendment, starting at the top. You'll see in lines 1.2 and line 1.3 of the A7 amendment, there's an insertion of the word written in both of those lines. Those apply to the definition of express consent that's in the bill. Specifically, express consent now must include written consent. And that is important because it is incumbent upon genetic testing companies in this bill when they are collecting, using, and disclosing consumers' genetic data, they must obtain a consumer's express consent. So the idea is that consent must be written as opposed to, say, the company calling someone up on the phone, getting oral consent that is not documented. Moving along, on line 1.4, there's a cleanup edit that just expands the definition of person to make sure it includes all potential entities and all potential representatives of an organization. A further definition is added to the definition section, that definition being service provider. In short, a service provider is a third party that a genetic testing company contracts with for certain portions of their business. That becomes important, as you'll see later in the amendment, as I describe additional requirements that are imposed upon such service providers. There's a couple of technical conforming edits that are made where written was included. Now we insert the word express because express does now incorporate written in its definition. If you look to line 1.16 of the A7 amendment, it refers you to page 4, line 10 of the bill. What that provision does is it requires a consumer's consent whenever their genetic data is going to be disclosed to, one, any entity offering health insurance, life insurance, or long-term care insurance, or two, any employer of the consumer. So the addition of this language in the A7 amendment says any consent under this paragraph must clearly identify the recipient of the consumer's genetic data proposed to be disclosed. The purpose of that is so that a genetic testing company can't receive a single consent that may the consumer may intend to only be disclosed to their health insurer, and then the testing company will then say, okay, that consent is therefore sufficient to disclose genetic data to the employer. So it just clarifies who the specific recipient of that genetic data will be. Moving along to line 1.19 of the amendment, it gives consumers the ability to revoke consent that they previously have given to a genetic testing company and imposes some requirements upon the testing companies in order to do so to make it easier for the consumer. Line 1.28 of the A7 amendment is a notice requirement to the consumer that the consumer's de-identified data may be shared with or disclosed to third parties for research purposes. And then the following subdivision 3 is where the service provider agreements I briefly touched upon earlier come into play. It imposes a mandatory provisions that must be included in the service contracts between the genetic testing companies and the third-party service providers. In addition, further down, you'll see a paragraph B that will be included in that same subdivision. That paragraph B reads, a service provider subject to this subdivision is subject to the same confidentiality obligations as a direct-to-consumer genetic testing company with respect to all biological samples, extracted genetic materials, and genetic material, or any information regarding the identity of any consumer in the service provider's possession. The idea there is that previously, the only recourse if a service provider violated one of their obligations under this law was as between the genetic testing company and the service provider, so it would have ultimately been a breach of contract claim. By adding this paragraph B, it provides the Commissioner of Commerce the authority to enforce obligations that are then imposed on the service provider, just as they could enforce confidentiality obligations for a genetic testing company. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Hudala. Senator Klein, any further remarks before we go to the witnesses? All right. With that, folks, we have three witnesses. The first one I have listed is Richie Engelhart from Ancestry.com. Mr. Engelhart. Mr. Engelhart, welcome to the committee. Could you please introduce yourself first and then present your testimony? We're hoping witnesses are in the 3 to 4 minute category, but yep. Fire away. Thank you.
Absolutely. Thank you, Chairman Klein, Ranking Member Dames. My name is Richie Engelhart, and I'm the head of government affairs at Ancestry, here today on behalf of the Coalition for Genetic Data Protection in support of SF 1138. Ancestry is proud of the work that we have done with our coalition partners, including 23andMe, to implement common sense privacy protections that ensure consumers are in control of their genetic data at all times. Together with privacy advocates in the Future Privacy Forum, a leading nonprofit that focuses on privacy thought leadership, best practices were developed that we believe are the appropriate guidelines for DTC genetic testing services. This includes ensuring consumers provide separate express consents, meaning we can't bury them in our terms of service or our privacy policy and hope you see it, for any collection, processing, or sharing of genetic data. This bill would require separate express consents for all of the following: analyzing a consumer's biological sample, storing that sample after the test has been analyzed for future testing opportunities, and that's completely optional. If the consumer says no, they can still use the service. Viewing genetic relatives on our websites, both parties have to consent before a match is revealed, so that's actually a double opt-in for that feature. using a consumer's genetic data for marketing purposes. And I'll note neither Ancestry nor 23andMe use genetic data for marketing purposes. It just doesn't pass the creepiness test for us. But if any other entity wanted to use genetic data for targeted advertising, they would have to get a separate express consent for that. Research. If a consumer opts in for research, that kicks them into an informed consent process because all of the research that our companies do is governed by institutional review boards and subject to the common rule, same as any clinical trial or human subject research in the US. And then sharing their data with any third party for any reason, we would need a separate express consent from that. Aside from the consents we must collect from consumers, they're empowered to delete their data at any time and have any biological samples they've previously stored destroyed. And they can end our relationship and leave no data, no biological samples. It tracks very closely to the right to be forgotten that you see in the European GDPR statute. SF 1138 puts these protections into law, outlining our responsibility to Minnesota consumers and clearly explaining their rights when they engage with direct-to-consumer genetic testing services to learn more about their genealogy or health. This approach has broad bipartisan support and stakeholder support. Since 2021, six states have enacted similar laws, including Arizona, California, Kentucky, Maryland, Utah, and Wyoming. While Ancestry and 23andMe have adhered to these practices the entire time we've offered DTC testing products, SF 1138 will ensure that every direct-to-consumer testing service is held to the same standards for privacy and data protection. And as Senator Klein noted, the A7 amendments pull in definitions for service providers, require that we provide notice that de-identified data can be used for research, and that tracks the same as HIPAA or the common rule, and clarify that, you know, if someone revokes consent and wants their data deleted, we have to do that within a 30-day time frame. Our customers' trust is our top priority. If they don't trust that we are keeping their data safe and respecting their privacy, they simply won't use us. This is an optional service. So we urge a favorable report on SF 1138, and I welcome any questions the committee may have.
Thank you very much, Mr. Englehart. Well, next, we would ask that Natasha Chernyovsky, hope I said that right, would come forward and testify. The Citizens Council for Health Freedom. Ms. Chernyovsky, how close did I get with that pronunciation?
Pretty close, yes.
Thank you. Well, regardless of how close I was, if you could please introduce yourself and present your testimony again. We're hoping for about 3 or 4 minutes if that fits.
Okay.
Thank you.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Natasha Chernyovsky, and I'm the Legislative and Policy Specialist for Citizens Council for Health Freedom. CCHF has long worked on genetic privacy, and we're very thankful for the effort that is brought forth by Senator Klein in addressing this issue. That said, we are concerned that this bill doesn't specifically provide and truly protect privacy and individual rights for consumers, but rather gives a false sense of security to consumers that those rights are protected. We appreciate the work that's been done with the A7 amendment and the improvement to privacy and clarity and consumer control. However, we are still deeply concerned by line 2.25 of the bill, which states that genetic data does not include de-identified data. Genetic data is written 20 times in this bill, possibly more so now with the A7 amendment. Haven't done that math yet. However, this, because de-identified data is no longer defined as genetic data, there are no protections in this bill for that subset. Even though it's still the person's blood or the person's spit, and those specimens and any related data will now be exempt from any protective provisions in this bill. In addition, as noted by 23andMe on their website, if an unpooled individual data, de-identified data is breached, a person could potentially be identified by that de-identified data through a public database. And so we do believe there's still a huge security concern and privacy concern for a person's security and their genetic privacy. Also, with reference in this bill to the federal common rule for federally funded research, it appears that this bill would transfer authority to federal officials to determine the definition, revocation, and notice for the consent and data sharing. Essentially, Minnesota is now ceding authority to federal regulators to regulations which could be changed by unelected officials under every administration, rather than determining these provisions by state law and allowing you as legislators to have that control and that decision-making power. Importantly, this includes the provisions in the federal law that, the federal rule for waiving consent requirements as permitted under Part 46 of Title 45. This bill appears to be less about privacy and more about providing companies with the right to use genetic data as they wish without consent. De-identified or not, it's still the consumer's genetic data. It's still their DNA, but under this bill, it won't be identified or protected as such. To truly protect consumers, line 2.25 should be deleted. Consumers have the right to protect their DNA regardless of whether it's de-identified or not. Also, just speaking briefly to the amendment regarding 13.386, we support this amendment. However, given that Chapter 13 protects the right to sue the government, we just would like to clarify and ask a question whether or not this truly gives individuals the right to sue private entities or to sue a company or service provider if their privacy is violated. Finally, if this committee does intend to pass the bill, we do have three suggestions to strengthen consumer protections, and this is in addition to that request to delete line 2.25. The first is that in 16-point font, the consent forms referenced in subdivision 2D, that disclosure statement about de-identified data, that would state something along the lines of, under Minnesota state law, genetic data that is de-identified is no longer considered genetic data and is not protected by the 2023 state law or genetic testing companies. Do not provide consent if you want to limit the use or the sharing of your DNA. Second, to require informed written consent, that express consent, if you want, specific to the de-identification of the specimen. So this, the consumer will be informed, they lose all rights to where it goes and what happens to that de-identified data, but that they have a choice as to whether it's de-identified in the first place. And then finally, on line 4.4, that consumers would be given access to an accounting of the disclosures so they know with whom and how often their data is being shared. Thank you all so much for your time and attention to our concerns. We appreciate the work that has been done and hope to come to just an even clearer conclusion for consumer privacy.
Thank you very much, Ms. Chernyovsky. Our final witness is Rich Neumeister. Mr. Neumeister, if you come forward.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm guided by the old adage by Senator Jack Davies. Good information makes good legislation.
Mr. Neumeister, if you don't mind, could you start, please, by introducing yourself so we can get that
I'm
on the
sorry,
record?
Mr. Chairman.
No, and again, we're hoping for 3 or 4 minutes, give
Mr.
or take.
Mr. Chairman, my Thank name is Rich much. Neumeister, and I'm a privacy advocate, transparency. I begin with an old adage that Jack Davies, a former president and chair of this Judiciary Committee at one time, says, good legislation is made with good information, and that's my intent to bring in this testimony. I will be commenting on this legislation that regulates the direct consumer genetic discrimination testing. It runs the gamut from little community businesses that have DNA on the corners all the way to the big folks. This is being pushed by the genetic industry. But I have one big concern, and I've always had over the years, is it for them or is it for me? In a way represent consumers from my perspective. And I think there needs to be a lot of improvement in the law or the proposed bill. It's coming there. I see some little adages here and there. But let me share with you some of those things. And it's through the prism of several things. One is fair information principles. If a company is going to have the most precious information about me through DNA, I want to make sure there's maximum clarity in my rights. When I say my, I'm saying for everybody's rights, consumer rights. And also the importance of where to redress the grievances. The first point, if you look at Amendment 6 that was offered to the public, it was polled. It had an item in there that would allow 13386 to be enforced, which is a genetic regulation under data practices. That applies to other persons. That was language that was adopted in the judiciary. And if I am hearing correct, the chief author of the bill, the chair of the committee, said that this will help with adequate enforcement. But the point is, if you look at 1308, it says only responsible authorities or government entities. So in A6, there was some language to correct that and to clarify that, but I believe that's been pulled. The bottom line, I believe there has to be some right of private action. This is a burgeoning industry. It's going to expand, and it's important for individuals and your constituents to have some accountability. Now, for the next point, if you take a look at my testimony on page 3, You'll see that I suggest a new language on line, page 3, line 9, a new three I's, or ones, or however they call it. I forget, when I read the drafting books, I forget. It says, information that clearly describes how to file a complaint alleging a violation of this section pursuant to 45027. That's the enforcement clause with the Department of Commerce. But the other thing that I think it's important for the Commerce to have, so by adopting this language, which is straight out of California, it says that you, the consumer, are notified how to file a complaint. The second thing, if you look at 45027, the Commerce Department gets all the money. In a lot of other enforcement mechanisms, it allows for sharing. So if I complain, the department finds some things, I can get part of the thing to redress my grievances rather than go to the general fund. Also, I suggest that there be rulemaking on this. On page 3, lines 14 through 17, you'll see a combined general separate or express consent. Those three lines really deal with elements of sharing. Straight out of the California language, I say, let's separate that, and you see the suggested language there. On page 4, line 9, after life insurance, I encourage disability insurance because I think that is appropriate, and it's also in other states, at least with California, unless there's something I'm not aware of in that regards. So, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, you've heard right direct the points are how to deal with right of private action. I think a couple things to make sure that I have adequate, and I speak for consumers, Minnesotans, and your constituents, have adequate to know where to complain, and three, real specific consent so that when they know where their samples are for each thing of accountability, they know. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, those are my comments, and I thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Neumeister. Are there any members of the public who wish to testify to the bill who we did not have on the list? Seeing no members of the public, thank you to the testifiers. Thanks, Senator Klein. Members, any questions? Senator Howe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator Klein, I'm looking at line 1.25 of the A7 amendment. And it basically says the company shall, well, revocation should happen as soon as practicable, but not later than 30 days. My question is what can the company do with that sample within that 30 days? What are they allowed to do?
Thank you, Senator Howe. Senator Klein.
Mr. Chair, Senator Howe, I might actually turn that over to Mr. Ritchie to speak specifically about company practices.
It's only fair.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. So as soon as practicable, I think would stop the company from doing anything that they don't have consent to do anymore. And the 30-day limit is really designed to reflect the realities of what it takes to destroy a sample. So these samples are stored in warehouses. If we get a request for deletion, we have to send the request over to the warehouse. The tray has to be pulled. That specific pipette has to be found with the consumer's biological sample in it, and it has to be destroyed. That is a process that takes more than a few days to complete. So this makes sure that we have to get that done within 30 days. But as soon as practicable, I think the courts would interpret that if we were to do something with someone's genetic data after they revoked consent, on the theory that we still had consent because there was a 30-day limit, that wouldn't fly.
Thank you, Mr. Engelhardt. Senator Howe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I guess, could we put some comfort language in there that says all processing must be stopped, or something to the effect, put a line in there that is, once that consent is revoked, the consumer revokes that consent, that all processing of that sampling cease? Because that's my concern is that you've got, and maybe your company is upstanding, but the next company that's in business may see that as that's a month I can process that, get the data, do what I want, maybe make it what's that line? One point that on, what is the way they say it? De-identified, and so they can get the de-identified data out of there and use that sample. I think that would make some folks a little bit more comfortable that says all processing of that sample stops, and so they don't continue to use that sample. That's my concern.
Thank you, Senator House. Senator Klein, you want to respond?
Mr. Chair, Senator, Mr. Ritchie.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I think that is something we can definitely look into. I need to go back to my product teams to make sure that I am fully understanding how data is taken out of the system so that we're not committing to something that we cannot do. Aside from the sample destruction, if you are in the database, whenever somebody signs up for Ancestry DNA, for example, to show them who their potential genetic relatives might be, we process their sample against everybody who's already in the database. And I'm not sure how quickly we can take that out, how quickly we can get that information, necessarily out of the rest of the system. I do know that happens much faster than 30 days. The data deletions are usually pretty fast, within a couple of website cycle updates. But I'd have to get some more information, and we can bring that to a future committee hearing as to how we can rein that in a little bit.
Thank you, Mr. Engelhardt. Senator Howe, do you have any follow-up? None from Senator Howe. Senator Rasmussen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I appreciate Senator Klein bringing this bill. I think it's important to have some consumer protections around the data and privacy involved with this type of genetic testing and analysis. I had one question, and maybe it's, or a few questions, maybe it's more appropriate for Mr. Engelhardt, but it's my understanding that Commerce would be the ones charged with enforcing this law. And I was just wondering under what mechanism would they actually enforce it? Because it's my understanding from reading the bill, there isn't like a licensing process or anything. Would they just have to bring suit against a potential violator? Or perhaps that question is best to Senator Klein.
Thank you, Senator Rasmussen. Senator Klein, you want to field that?
Mr. Chair, I do. Senator Rasmussen, you and I must be thinking alike. I had that same discussion with the department to feel if they needed some sort of licensure or registration to empower them to enforce to the extent that this law demands that they do, and they declined, and they felt that they had adequate purview with the language as it is.
Thank you, Senator Klein. Senator Rasmussen, any follow-up?
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Senator Klein. I appreciate having that conversation. And because it was raised by one of the testifiers, just wanted to give either the bill author or Mr. Engelhardt an opportunity to potentially respond. And I'm looking at line 2.25 on the bill as introduced. And it says in there, genetic data does not include de-identified data. And so I was wondering if Mr. Engelhardt or the bill author could help this committee understand how genetic data could be de-identified, because at least like the common reading I would have is DNA is inherently identifying. And so if you could just explain what would fall into that category and what wouldn't fall into that category would be helpful.
Thank you, Senator Rasmussen. Senator Klein, you or perhaps Mr. Engelhardt? Mr. Engelhardt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Yeah, and I think if you look at the language around de-identified data and what's required for it to be shared, inherent in that definition is the fact that, of course, it can be re-identified, right? You wouldn't need contractual prohibitions for re-identifying data if it could not be re-identified. So the research community understands that. And with the A7 amendment, we have to provide notice that your de-identified data could be shared for research under the common rule. That's the 45 CFR Part 46. We also require that you opt in for that research. So if you don't opt in for that research, you can't be in the de-identified data set as the bill is structured. If you do opt in for research, then the common rule takes over. And this definition for de-identified data tracks to both the common rule and HIPAA, as well as the FTC enforcement standard. And when you deal with research, de-identified data sets are used all the time in genetic research. They flow from research institutions that we partner with to us and vice versa when we're trying to do things like identify genetic markers that may, suggest that you have a higher risk for cancer, or the genetic marker is actually the cause of the cancer. So this is not anything that isn't happening every day in research institutions, DTC testing companies, hospitals, what have you. Really under the purview of research and governed by the common rule. This is all informed consent. Nobody is going into this, without their eyes wide open as to how the research is conducted.
Thank you, Mr. Engelhardt. Senator Rasmussen, any follow-up?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. No, and I do appreciate the bill author adding some consumer disclosure and protections today in the amendment, and so appreciate him working with stakeholders. And I would just say one other thing about DNA testing in general, which it kind of makes this a unique privacy issue, is that when an individual is giving out their DNA, it's not only their DNA, but they're actually connected to siblings, parents, children, and so it has unique privacy concerns. And so I'm glad this committee is taking a look at it and addressing this important issue for Minnesota consumers.
Thank you, Senator Rasmussen. Members, any other questions for the author or any of the testifiers? If not, we'll go back to the author, Senator Klein.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and to the committee for those great suggestions and for considering this bill. And it's true, as Senator Rasmussen has pointed out, there is currently no legislation around this area, which clearly has a significant impact on Minnesotans' privacy rights. So I'm grateful for the industry for bringing it forward. I'm also truly grateful, and let me express my particular thanks to Rich Neumeister and the advocates from Health Freedom, because we are fortunate in this state to have a very powerful and organized and intelligent group of individuals who protect health privacy. And while we don't always agree, I think they always come with a good, honest intention to protect Minnesotans. And I have tried as an author, chief author, to be responsive to their concerns. The intention of this bill, Mr. Chair, is to lay it over for possible inclusion. So if there are continued issues or deficits in the bill, there will be opportunities to improve it. And with that, I would ask you to lay it over, Mr. Chair.
Senator Klein moves to lay the bill over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, say nay. With that, the bill is laid over. Thank you, Senator Klein. I don't see any other business before the committee. And with that, we are adjourned.
Sorry, Mr. Ritchie.
Oh, yes.